I'm Christopher Lydon. This is The Connection. It's an odd quirk of the American system that the national protection of rights for women and minorities and even endangered species rests significantly on commerce. That fine point of the law, which is probably lost on a lot of us, is at the heart of this week's Supreme Court decision limiting the Violence Against Women Act. The so-called Commerce Clause says that the national government holds the power to regulate anything that affects business between the states. Delaware Senator Joe Biden sponsored that Violence Against Women Act with a finding that rape, wife battering, stalking, and other crimes against women were costing the country between $5 and $10 billion every year in medical costs and lost productivity and opportunity. Chief Justice William Rehnquist, however, disagreed. Gender-motivated crimes of violence are not, in any sense of the phrase, economic activity, he wrote in his majority opinion published Monday. We're talking this hour on The Connection about a Supreme Court decision that some people call judicial activism and others call a victory for the Constitution and its balance. Connection listeners, how do you balance the need to protect women from violence and the need to protect states from a national tyranny? Can we uncouple prosecution of crimes like rape or wife battering and stalking from business economics and still respect the Constitution? Our phone is 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. Get you to the Connection Bar. Joining us in our studio are Charles Freed, former Solicitor General, professor of law at the Harvard Law School, co-counsel on the winning side of this case. Also in the studio, Diane Rosenfeld, who also teaches at Harvard, former senior counsel for the Violence Against Women Office at the Department of Justice in the Clinton administration. Connection listeners, what's at stake here? 1-800-423-8255. Diane Rosenfeld, what do you see as the stakes in this case, and what happened? Did you expect to see this law reversed?
I actually am shocked by this decision, even in light of the Lopez decision, which constricted for the first time in about 50 years Congress's ability to regulate a problem it saw fit to regulate under the Commerce Clause. And the reason is that in Lopez, there was no legislative record like there was here, and there was also not a discrimination problem noted. So it fell on its lack of relationship, it being the Gun-Free School Zones Act, fell based on its lack of relationship to interstate commerce. But Lopez was clearly distinguishable. And here, a democratically elected Congress held 4 years of extensive hearings on violence against women and particularly its effect on the national economy. And they found that states had significant problems in their criminal justice systems with gender bias infecting their systems and decided that this was the appropriate remedy. It was quite limited, and that it was the appropriate remedy to address gender-motivated violence. It's a hard thing to address gender-motivated violence because a lot of people don't understand the gender bias that animates so much violence against women and deprives them of equal protection of the laws.
But we all know in sort of Constitution 101 that the Constitution reserves to the states powers that are not explicitly given to it reserves the states powers that are not explicitly given to the federal government. In this case, why shouldn't the normal jurisdiction of violent crime stay where it's always been at the state and local court level? What, in other words, what was there in the findings before Biden that overwhelmed that presumption that these things ought to be tried, like murder and a lot of other heinous crimes, at the local level?
Because the local level was actually asking for help. State and local governments, as represented by state officials and by their federal officials or federal representatives, were all saying, we need help here. We have gender bias that so infects our criminal justice system that it results in a systematic deprivation of equal protection for women, and we need to do something about it. So they worked together. They came to the federal government, to Congress, and said, please help us address this problem. 41 states lobbied Congress in favor of it. 36 states signed on to the brief in support of upholding the constitutionality of this very important provision. That seems to be that seems to have been lost on the majority.
A lot of us lived through the history in the 50s and 60s of the civil rights legislation, in which all manner of Mississippi trials demonstrated the incapacity or unreadiness of states to grant any kind of racial fairness in the law, which prompted, of course, a huge national, the Civil Rights Acts of the 60s. Is that what you're saying was required in the case of protecting women against rape?
Well, it seemed to fit into that structure that we had to show that there was a substantial effect on interstate commerce as well as a deprivation of equal protection. So, as you know, the act was passed on both prongs and was just recently stricken down on both prongs, on the 14th Amendment enforcement clause and on the Commerce Clause. But the Commerce Clause, there were definitely Commerce Clause justifications set forth and very solidly agreed upon in the record of the economic effect on violence against women. It was estimated in 1990 to be $3 billion, not million, billion dollars in lost wages and medical expenses and lost jobs. And even in Christy Brancala's case, she's been unable to pursue her college education, as so many rape victims, especially on campuses, are it's the fate with which they have to deal. It's always on the rape victim to suffer the consequences of the rape, and she always suffers economically. So Christy has not been able to finish college. That hurts the economy in the aggregate, that the economy will not have the benefits of her services.
Charles Fried, why didn't the court grant a federal jurisdiction here? Why, in your view, shouldn't it have?
Well, Diane rightly says that the states asked for help, and they got it, and they got a lot of help, which was perfectly valid and nobody questioned, and which really is the kind of help that's going to help. For instance, there was some $1.5 billion, I think, given to the states to help them train prosecutors and judges in dealing with gender-motivated attacks. It gave money to the states to help them with battered women's shelters, very important stuff. And that's all perfectly constitutional, because the Constitution says the federal government may spend for the general welfare, and this is plainly the general welfare, and they were spending for the general welfare. It does not, however, say that the federal government may regulate for the general welfare, and that's the line that they crossed. They moved from spending to regulating in this very particular thing, which is a lawsuit, private lawsuit against attackers. Incidentally, there's a criminal provision which the court specifically said is quite unproblematic. The criminal provision requires that the crime have an interstate element, that people cross a state line and in the course of it. And that's not, the criminal provision is beyond question. So all we have is this single thing, the lawsuit in federal court. Now, Diane talks about the billions of dollars lost, and the record speaks very dramatically and quite properly about how women are often afraid to work at night, are afraid to use public transportation because of the danger of violence against them. Fine. How does a lawsuit help against the attacker help that? I mean, be real. The notion that you're going that the rapist or attacker who is lurking in the bushes at night, and that's where the great fears come. That's where the $5 billion come. That bringing a lawsuit against that attacker is going to make a difference.
Because this provision gets at the gender bias that is behind violence against women. It's not just the attacker, it's the abuse at home as well. And you bring up a very important point, though, about the other two main provisions of the Violence Against Women Act still being completely intact. And it's important for the listeners and for women's advocates and for everyone to know that, because in a lot of the press, it looks as if the entire Violence Against Women Act was held unconstitutional. which it was not. So the federal criminal provisions are still good and were specifically left untouched in the Supreme Court opinion. And those include crimes that have an interstate component. So if you cross a state line in violation of an order of protection or to commit domestic violence, you have committed a federal crime for which the U.S. attorneys will prosecute you.
Well, this recalls the Mann Act, but it hasn't made rape a federal crime exactly, has it? Or has it?
No, rape is not actually part of the Federal Violence Against Women Act in the federal criminal provisions. And then the next provision that Charles was talking about is also quite important. It was $1.6 billion given to states that's administered through the Department of Justice to help them build effective responses. And I totally agree that both of those are very, very important provisions. And the Department of Justice has made enormous strides in helping states to address this problem. But it still didn't get at exactly the equal protection problem. Like the heart of the matter was this act. The heart and soul of the Violence Against Women Act is the right to be free from gender-motivated violence. And now, after we've spent years proving it, figuring out a remedy, getting bipartisan support, passing it overwhelmingly, now it's stricken down. And I think it's just unconscionable that we've been given this right that makes sense to so many women. We understand how violence by men against us constricts our lives, our movements, our liberties, and our very citizenship.
Charles Fried, do you want to respond to that? I have a further question.
Yes, I certainly do. It's a terrible thing, violence against women. As Diane on another occasion kindly said, when I was a judge, I wrote an opinion as a state court judge talking about the terrors and the horrors of domestic violence. But the great defect here is that because this is an important cause, the women's movement thought that somehow it wouldn't get the proper dignity it required unless you could bring a lawsuit in federal court. So the notion is the federal courts have got to become the billboard for this particular slogan. It's a totally symbolic thing. The notion that so many of these harms can be cured by getting the trial lawyers into federal court is just a big mistake.
I find that completely insulting and inconsistent with your commitment to doing something about violence against women, to consider this as simply a billboard symbolic issue, which it is. Definitely.
It's not the issue. It's the lawsuit for civil damages brought by the trial lawyers in federal courts.
One of the very important parts of the civil rights remedy was that for the first time, it gave a woman control over her lawsuit against her abuser. So she didn't have to go begging a prosecutor to believe her. And states in their 21 gender bias task force studies that they entered into evidence that were, you know, in support of passing this act, documented time and time again that rape victims, for example, are treated much less seriously than other victims of crime.
That's completely.
But she doesn't have to. It's quite important that she has this in her own hand.
She has it in her own hand. As the Chief Justice said at the end of this opinion, any civilized system would have given Christie Brunkhalla a remedy. And in fact, VPI settled with her, which is something people, you know, they settled for $75,000. They didn't want to go to trial. A woman who is a victim of a rape has the thing in her own hands because she can bring exactly the same civil action in state court. You don't need a prosecutor to bring a battery action in federal.
An assault and battery action available in, you know, I guess all states. That you can bring civilly will not likely address the gender motivation, the gender bias that underlies it. And also state systems have been found defective to a large extent.
What they found is that prosecutors, state prosecutors, and police may be insufficiently sensitive.
Right, and who else is going to help bring that case to justice if not the prosecutors and the police and the judges?
Diane, it's what you're saying is totally illogical. What you're saying is that the solution, therefore, is to give the victim a private cause of action in federal court. But how is that a solution to a problem that doesn't exist when she would have the same cause of action? It wouldn't have the same name, but it would be a cause of action for assault or battery, which she also had, which doesn't bring the police and the prosecutors into it any more in state court than in federal court. And it would occur in both cases in front of a local jury.
Because
so I don't see what the difference is.
The local juries have been part of the problem. And
but you'd get a local jury in federal court, too. The Constitution demands it.
Sean, I want to go back to an underlying question here. What is, in your view, what is or is not the correspondence in the women's situation to the black situation in the South in the pre-civil rights era? In other words, we learned not to trust local juries in race cases in the 50s and 60s.
For very good reason.
What is the correspondence or lack of it with women here?
Chris, the huge blunder here is to say, because we don't trust local juries when a woman brings an assault and battery action in state court, she should get into federal court. But the Constitution requires that in federal court she have a local jury, so it'll be the same jury. I just don't get it.
Well, it's a federal system, but have a federal judge, and it might be less likely to be affected. She also could bring this action in state court. This is actually a perfect, or was before it got stricken down, a perfect example of really effective federalism. It was a very coordinated, cooperative state effort, state and federal effort, to address violence against women. So all the various components of the act require that states and the federal government work together to address it. And this was a case, one of the things I'm quite concerned about is this was a case where the states were going to the federal government saying, we need help with this problem. We can't ignore the equal protection problems that states found and that they claimed in their own gender bias task force. So they go to the federal government and they say, we need help. We want to work with you on addressing this problem that we have found endemic in our system. The federal government takes action, passes a reasonable and quite limited act that will not, you know, bring down the system because of its volume or impose any dangers like that. And it gets stricken down, and it gets stricken down ironically because so as not to interfere with states' rights. But now states have actually lost the right to seek help from the federal government on things that they need help from.
It's not a question of states' rights. It's a question of the Constitution. The states can ask. The states are not in a position to say, hey, we give up, you do it for us, federal government.
The states weren't saying that. They were saying, we will work with you on these other programs to improve our response.
And those programs are fine.
And those programs are fine. But while we're doing that, pass this to address the other problem, because
it doesn't address it.
I want to ask
it's just
you
symbolic.
Both, but I think the burden's on you, Charles, in a way. The public accommodation sections of the Civil Rights Law in 64, banning racial exclusion or discrimination by hotels or motels or restaurants was based on the Commerce Clause.
Correct.
Okay. And it was upheld, and I presume you think it ought still to be there. Why doesn't that logic...
And so did the court specifically in both this case and the 1995 case specifically said those are still good law.
So
no
what,
question.
Exactly. What, spell out the gap between that problem and that remedy and this case, in which you don't think the interference with commerce or the nature of the class or the group or the injury warrants this kind of federal jurisdiction.
What the court said in this case and in the guns in schools case was that all the previous cases involved economic activity. Transportation is obviously an economic activity. Interstate commerce and transportation couldn't be, they're the same thing. Hotels are part of the channels of communication. The Heart of Atlanta Motel was a place where black people traveled, were not traveling through the South, were not able to stay. So that's all part of interstate movement and travel. This only gets to be interstate commerce because when a woman is hurt, she can't work. And when she can't work, she can't spend, and the economy is hurt. And as the Chief Justice said, if that is a basis, then mugging, murder, car theft may be more easily because cars move.
But those weren't related to an equal protection problem.
And well, are we talking Commerce Clause or are we talking equal protection?
We're talking both. I think to bifurcate them completely is wrong.
Well, you can't talk about them both at the same time. You got to talk about one or the other. Is it commerce?
Well, it is commerce, and it is also equal protection.
So which one are we going to talk about?
We will talk about both. I mean, authority of Congress to keep channels of interstate commerce free from immoral and injurious uses.
It's time to consult the Connection Jury. 1-800-423-8255. 1-800-423-TALK. On the Supreme Court's judgment Monday against the Violence Against Women Act. 1-800-423-TALK. Ted is on the line. Hello, Ted. You want to be jury foreman?
Yep. Love to.
Go for it.
I think if you really want to protect women and give them the right to not just after the fact, after they get raped or beat up, have a lawsuit, I think you ought to allow them to carry firearms. It's been proven to work. And it makes women feel more safe.
How large a weapon did you have in mind? Nuclear?
any size.
Well, Ted, I don't actually want to go that far, but I think that there is a significant equal protection problem, and we really need to think hard about and make a point of the fact that most violence in this country is committed by men, and violence against women is overwhelmingly 90%, according to the Bureau of Justice Statistics, committed by men against women. So there's a very gendered dimension here to just the even commission of violence, and it means that equal protection means something different to women than it does to men. It means that women have to rely on men for their protection.
Well, I don't think that you're going to have men not commit violence against women just because there's a possibility they could get sued in federal court or any other court.
Well, I think though the consequences matter, and I think that men commit a lot of violence against women, especially intimate partner violence, because they can. They know they'll get away with it. They know that rapes aren't prosecuted. They're not even reported most of the time. They know that domestic violence is taken much less seriously than other crimes. They know that orders of protection don't mean anything, that judges aren't going to impose serious sanctions on them for committing it. They won't send them to jail.
We lost 50 women in Boston one year who had restraining orders against men, and they came in and killed them anyway.
Exactly, my point, that orders of protection, men know that orders of protection don't actually work to protect women.
But those women are still dead. They wouldn't be alive if there was the ability to sue. The men are probably dead, most of them as well. If the women had a firearm, this was a study done by John Lott.
The Boston 50 is a very interesting statistic because Massachusetts is one of the best states on this subject. We are one of the most vigorous states in protecting the rights of women. And still,
this
happens. It's a dreadful thing. I think it's preposterous to think that those women would somehow be alive if they could have gotten some trial lawyer to bring a suit in federal court instead of state court where they can bring the suit.
Well, the suit has something to do with equal protection, and it has symbolic importance
just what I've been saying.
Not to leave it at symbolic, though, but it does, because a high impact litigation case where other women know that they have the possibility of bringing this suit and other batterers or rapists know that they will be held accountable for their behavior and financially accountable would be interesting and could be a very effective remedy.
This suit is only worth bringing if the defendant is worth suing, right? What's the point of a suit for damages for somebody who has no money?
Right. That's probably right. But there are a lot of men with money
it's
who
certainly
batter.
Certainly right.
But there are a lot of men with money who batter.
And
there are
men with
all
money
across the board.
Who batter. I'll take their case in state court, and I'll win.
Well, good. But why do you think that state court is such a preferable forum?
I don't say it's a preferable forum. I think it's the forum which the Constitution gives these women, gives victims of battery and assault, men or women. And there is no evidence, none, in this record, that when women bring civil actions for battery, for damages, they somehow are badly treated.
Diane, isn't the burden on you really to say why the federal jurisdiction is better? And again, in the civil rights case, in the racial cases, it was because state courts were defiantly, openly refusing to take civil rights racial crimes seriously.
Right, exactly.
But
and
in Massachusetts, you say the problem exists against a very significant effort to do something.
Well, Massachusetts is better than a number of states on these issues, but the 50
Who's
women
better
who
than
were
Massachusetts?
Murdered...
On that question, let's just take a short break. We're talking about the Violence Against Women Act, which was significantly compromised on Monday by the United States Supreme Court. This is The Connection from WBUR Boston and PRI Public Radio International. Funding for The Connection comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where The Connection is produced, and from the Allaire Corporation, empowering people with innovative internet technology and offering dynamic career opportunities at Allaire.com. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is The Connection. We're talking about the Supreme Court's decision Monday against the Violence Against Women Act, specifically the provision that would have allowed women to file civil suits against rapists in the federal court. It was a 5-4 decision. The majority, Rehnquist, O'Connor, Kennedy, Scalia, and Thomas, against the minority of Stevens, Souter, Ginsburg, and Breyer. Close enough, particularly in an atmosphere where the next president of the United States can count on appointing two justices to spill over into the presidential campaign, too. Is this the sort of thing you want to hear George W. Bush and Al Gore debating in a presidential election?
I would. I definitely would. I mean,
that's Diane
Clinton.
Rosenfeld, lecturer at the Harvard Law School, who was senior counsel for the Violence Against Women Office in the Justice Department. Charles Fried, professor of law at Harvard, is also in our studio. He was co-counsel to the winning side that limited the Violence Against Women Act in this case. What's the argument for a presidential campaign, Diane?
Well, President Clinton worked very hard on this act, and then in 1995 created the office in which I used to serve at the Department of Justice specifically to implement this act, both within the various components of the Department of Justice and to help the entire nation realize that we were there to help and ways in which we could help and things like that. And it went a long way toward increasing public understanding of violence against women as a major social, public health, horrible problem that was limiting the citizenship of women. So, and it's very important that we have a president who's totally committed to this. So I guess you can...
Are we going to add this to the litmus tests on Supreme Court appointments for presidential candidates, Charles Fried?
Well, I think what might become part of the test, if you like, is a commitment to respecting the constitutional structure, which assigns... respecting the constitutional structure, which assigns certain subjects to the states and certain subjects to the federal government, namely only those which are set out in the Constitution. That's how the issue would be framed.
And I'm sure that Governor Bush would be, you know, all too happy to leave discrimination as something that the states would be kind of more free to do and freedom from, you know, these issues get couched in terms of freedom from federal regulation, but what they really do is provide a pretext for the ability to discriminate without consequence.
Gee, I think you should not really make that charge, that somehow Governor Bush would like to see the states free to discriminate. I don't know where you get that.
He's a states' rights person, and he argues for states' rights a lot, and I'm just inferring from that. Because
so does the Constitution, in fairness, right?
Sure, no. States do have rights, but the states' rights in this case were not limited in the way that this case says that they
were. I want to go back to calls, but I'd like you to join the issue, which I don't think really has been clarified here, is why do you and the whole court agree that the use of the Commerce Clause and the 14th Amendment to protect blacks from discrimination is a good thing, and yet you, Charles, and the majority in the court don't believe the same logic applies to women at the hands of batterers.
At the hands of batterers, what is quite clear is that the same statute, 64 Civil Rights Act, which protects blacks against discrimination in employment and public accommodations, also protects women. There's no question of that. They're both
protected. There's no question of that. I think a really interesting kind of big picture philosophical issue here is that violence against women, gender-based violence, is different from race-based violence because in race, not race-based violence, but racial discrimination, because in race discrimination, you can exclude more easily racial minorities from your life. They're a visible, discrete minority, and you can exclude them from public accommodations, and then that's more visible. But the kind of bias that we're talking about in gender-based crimes is kind of less visible because it's much harder and less practical for a man to exclude women from his life because he's going to have to deal with them and he most likely will have an intimate partner. So that the gender bias gets expressed through violent domination rather than through exclusion. And I think that also because women are a majority, actually, it's much harder for people to accept that we should have more rights because it really threatens that we could change the entire power structure of the society if we were free to participate.
It's the caller's turn. 1-800-423-8255 or 1-800-423-TALK with Charles Fried and Diane Rosenfeld arguing the violence against women decision by the Supreme Court. Michael is calling from Messina, New York.
Greetings.
And to you, Michael.
A wonderful show as always. I'm a solo practicing attorney in northern New York. The closest federal court is 3 hours to the south in Syracuse. I find Mr. Fried's logic persuasive, particularly in my case, because if a woman was to come to me and wanted to bring an action in federal court, the costs, which are already very high and unaffordable to most, would be all the worse if we had to go to federal court. And I think the attraction...
You'd get attorney's fees, though, Michael.
Oh, but, Michael, actually, you raise a good point, and I'm sorry if I wasn't clear on this. The civil rights provision is... It also allowed an action to be commenced in state court.
Michael?
I mean...
So you could go to state court and bring your claim there.
Under the federal law.
Under the federal law,
yeah,
right.
The court of general jurisdiction, and I think that points to Mr. Fried's argument that state courts, the system establishing state courts and the reason they're there is for them to be courts of general jurisdiction. And the federal courts should be difficult to get into. That was the plan. And to, you know, the continual expansion of federal jurisdiction, particularly since I was a student clerk for a federal judge in Boston, his complaint was the flood of drug cases. He's like, I'm not a drug.
Well, there was concern
drug case judge.
In the history of the passage of the Violence Against Women Act. There was concern expressed by Chief Justice Rehnquist and the Conference of Chief Justices about floodgating, and they worked with Congress and other officials to narrow this provision, and then they withdrew their objection to that provision because it was a more narrowly crafted thing. And it turned out that, you know, only 50 cases approximately have been brought under the act. So the floodgates fair is really, really seriously overblown.
Diane, you can't have it both ways. This, what you call symbolic and I call billboarding provision, can't at the same time both be the great solution to what I agree is a horrible phenomenon, and also no problem at all. You can't be both Chicken Little and Dr. Pangloss at the same time.
I'm not sure exactly what you mean by that.
What I mean is you can't say it's not going to overwhelm the federal courts. They're not going to have this vast
right.
new flood
and it's
of
a
business.
Very important right. Why is that inconsistent?
It's a very important right.
And it's not going to flood the federal
it's
courts.
It's a very important right, which every state in the union allows you to bring a civil action for there before a local jury, which is the same jury that you must have in federal court.
But it doesn't get to the discriminatory, the bigger picture of how can we as a society address most effectively violence against women.
Change the subject a little bit, Diane? It sounds to me as if you'd like to, see a new appointment or two to that court and run the case by them again. But pending that, or in the alternative, what other kinds of remedies are there, do you think, for what women lost on Monday?
You're right, I do. I think that, again, the next election is going to be very, very, very important for women, and it's very important that we continue this work. But that's a very good question. I think that there should be efforts, and I know that there is one underway in Illinois, to pass gender bias motivated crime bills on a state-by-state basis. And I think that that will be the next political strategy and the next wave of how we
What's your idea, Charles, this? Of a remedy for what you're calling a horrible problem?
Now, if Charles is, talking up state courts and saying it's a local problem, I think that he would probably agree that a gender-based violence act on a state level would be something he'd be in favor of.
No problem.
Go
and
ahead.
In fact, one of the things, and it's really pretty ironic, that was used by the dissents in this case to say, of course, the states have a terrible problem, is that the states themselves had funded these 20 or 21 gender bias task forces in which the state says, we've got to get our act together and deal better with women in court. So the states are doing this. And what is also ironic is not only the states, but the different federal circuits had their gender bias studies, and they found the same things.
Right. So this.
So it's
this is...
just the idea of we can get, the old joke, don't make a federal case out of it. So somehow it's not important.
Right. So we should make
not,
a federal case
it's
out
not
of it.
Important.
It's violence against us.
It's not important unless you can make a federal case out of it. And that is what I object to. Lots of things are important which are not a federal case.
And I think our citizenship is quite important.
1-800-423-8255. Makes the Violence Against Women Act connection. Bernadette is on the line.
Yes, I think it's important to take into account the history and religious background of this. Throughout most of U.S. history, wife beating was legal. Woman was legally defined as inferior to her husband. He had the right to chastise her. This is in part based on religious, specifically Christian understandings of the subordination of women within marriage. In some states today, men still may rape their wives.
I think one state.
Oh, I think it's more than that, Charles. Similarly, with respect to rape, we have a religious tradition of considering rape less serious than other sins. For example, Thomas Aquinas wrote that sodomy, abortion, and contraception are worse than rape and incest because rape and incest are natural even though illegal. And this background helps us to understand why it is that the Supreme Court has changed its interpretation of the Commerce Clause that existed from 1942 until 1945, according to which if there was a substantial effect on the on commerce, on the economy, that Congress was allowed to legislate on these matters, why the Supreme Court now has turned in another direction. The courts have always been very focused on having domestic relations being taken care of by the state. So the domestic relations are the prime example of state jurisdiction. And this,
what's to be done about it, Bernadette? I mean,
to be done about it is for religious communities to be involved in pushing for change, including for laws against laws at a state level or laws at a federal level, for example, laws that may target specific states that have marital exemptions or...
I think the marital rape thing is very interesting, and I completely agree with you. That is outrageous, and a law which says that a husband cannot rape his wife is an unconstitutional law. And I think a wife who brings an action, a civil action in state court, and is met by that as a defense, can take that to the Supreme Court and get that law thrown out.
Well, of
which
course,
is, of
but,
course,
I mean,
we've
done that in most states, and
you've done it and you've succeeded.
Right, but Bernadette, you raised some really good points, and I'd love to work with you. So, if you'd like to leave your number, I'll definitely contact you about future efforts. But the historical aspect of violence against women is really critical, and rape used to be considered a property crime, and it was considered a trespass to a man's property. So the woman's body was his property. And we've come a really long way from the historical foundations of violence against women and the bad attitudes that animated them. But we have a much longer way to go because male entitlement is still so integral to intimate partner relationships. And attitudes are still so bad. So here's an interesting quote.
We do have a long way to go.
How does
bringing lawsuits in federal court instead of state court take you any part of that distance?
Because we can
Except
make a federal
the trial
case
lawyers.
On this. Because this is an important thing, and like you were saying slightly sarcastically before, we should make a federal case out of that.
Well, you were saying we shouldn't.
I know you were saying.
I want to get back to the callers. 1-800-423-8255. Jeff is listening on the web in New York City.
Yes, Chris, and enjoy your show.
Thank you, Jeff.
It seems that, and this has been mentioned a few times, but one of the proponents wants it to go to federal court because it seems as if the government is taking it seriously. If it's in federal court versus state court, it must be important because it's in federal court. So I would agree with Judge or Professor Free, whichever it is, that does go to perception. I enjoy the conversation between your two guests on the economic impact in the jurisdiction. But again, any victim of a crime, you know, robbery, certainly murder, you could extrapolate what a murder victim would have made in the course of his or her lifetime, and that's an economic impact because they're not going to be spending for the next 50 years. So that would automatically get any crime victim or their you know, children or whoever.
Right.
But I don't think that's really the point, and that gets you into federal jurisdiction. What I am curious, and I'd like to hear the conversation regarding the equal protection argument. I didn't hear that argument from your two guests. And also, I'd like to know what the dissent said. Did they come down giving jurisdiction on an economic impact or an equal protection? And
well, what happened with the dissent is the majority of the court spent 7/8 of their time talking about the Commerce Clause and 1/8 about the equal protection for reasons we can get into later. The dissent spent all of their time talking about the Commerce Clause because they disagreed about that. And if they had prevailed on that score, they wouldn't have needed to get to the equal protection. So this case did not really address the equal protection argument.
Because equal protection has been considered historically a legitimate aim of the Commerce Clause, that there has been precedent for addressing both of these problems together, like in the race cases.
I'm afraid I don't understand.
Like Heart of Atlanta, that if you can't stay in a hotel, it will have, you know, it's an equal protection problem, but it's legitimate to address it through the Commerce Clause
authority. Because it's an economic problem. Because it is as the court
also, the dissent said that it found it shocking, as did I, that the majority just seemed to dismiss the economic evidence that had been submitted to Congress about the devastating effects on the economy.
They dismissed pointed out that devastating effect is the same devastating effect that you would get from murder, from mugging,
but that's where the
from
equal
robbery.
Protection becomes relevant.
But the equal protection is you keep wanting to run these two things together. Are you talking
they
commerce clause?
They historically have been run together.
No, are you talking? You know, the one section is in Article 1, Section 8. The other is Section 5 of the 14th Amendment. They're two different things.
1-800-423-8255. Rescues the lawyers from this argument. 1-800-423-TALK. Dan is on the line.
Yes, Chris. Another excellent show.
Thank you.
My question is that if the Commerce Clause reaches domestic violence, one of your guests is arguing, what's left of federalism and the division of powers between the federal and the reservation of powers to the state? It seems to me that one can always construct a contingent argument that a crime, as Professor Fried has pointed out, causes economic impact. I just don't see if the dissent's interpretation were accepted as law, what would be left of the Commerce Clause?
Diane Rosenfeld.
We would bring down the whole house. Everything would just fall completely. If we gave women the right to be free from gender-motivated violence, it would be really tragic.
If every crime that has some economic consequence
I don't think you really need to limit it. You needn't limit it to crimes. Look, there's no doubt that things like marriage, divorce, custody, and alimony, and all of these things have a tremendous economic effect, exactly like the one that is urged in this situation.
And those were specifically excluded from this statute.
They were specifically in this statute. But unless the court had held this line, the next statute could constitutionally make you could make a federal case out of every divorce and out of every custody and out of every alimony case on exactly that logic.
But it wouldn't happen because it's unlikely that it would happen.
But it would be constitutional, wouldn't it, Diane?
Well, it depends on what Congress went through when it made the legislation
But don't you think
this
exactly that evidence exists?
This case completely discounts what Congress did. This case is a threat to democracy.
Oh, yes, so is the case which threw out the law saying that it's that you can be put in jail for burning the American flag, a threat to democracy. And that probably had the same lineup as this did.
Diane, I want to ask you, is the Commerce Clause the only route into a federal remedy for violence against women?
Good question. Equal protection.
Equal protection, certainly.
Protection.
I agree with that. Equal protection, but the 14th Amendment says that you are guaranteed equal protection and violations of equal protection by the state. And what the court said in this case is, fine, so sue the state.
Another variation of the same question. People say now more than ever women need the Equal Rights Amendment. Would that have been a sounder platform for this kind of a legislation?
Well, prospectively, no, because at the time it looked like this was, you know, they went through great pains to make it constitutional and constitutionally feasible. They did all their homework, basically. But now the majority of the Supreme Court just changed the rules dramatically in a very activist decision. So the background playing rules aren't the same. Need a new strategy.
Don't you think this is the same? This is the same decision as the 1995 law, which again had vast congressional support.
No, I don't.
Which makes
there was not an equal protection problem there, and there weren't 4 years or anything even close of testimony
that you could have exactly the same findings on alimony. You could get exactly the same findings.
No, I will not admit that.
Oh, I see.
Okay.
Well,
no admissions. Diane Rosenfeld, Charles Fried, thank you enormously for joining us.
Thank you, Chris.
On the
it
connection.
Was great.
Listeners can continue the conversation about the Supreme Court's decision limiting the Violence Against Women Act on our website at theconnection1word.org. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is The Connection from WBUR Boston. Thank you. Funding for The Connection comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where The Connection is produced, and from the Allaire Corporation.
PRI, Public Radio International.
This is WBUR. We're funded by you, our listeners, and by Raymond's Home and Carpets, featuring fine furnishings and oriental carpets for the home, 274 Moody Street in Waltham, and Raymond's Rugs, 68 Highland Avenue in Needham.